Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, James Whitey Bulger takes a helicopter to court. Federal prosecutors get what they want, and the accused mobster gets a lawyer.
It's going to be a daunting task, but we're going to be up to it. We guarantee that.
Also this week, two scenes of summer fun, a playground and a public pool, both turned into scenes of summer tragedy. A four-year-old boy shot in the back at a Dorchester playground.
But it just seemed like it's no place safe for the kids anymore. I don't care where they go, it's no place safe for them. And this should be a safe haven for them. And it's not.
And a woman drowns in a public pool in Fall River and goes undiscovered for 2 days.
How did nobody see anything?
Both events have residents asking how this could happen and how they can keep their kids safe.
And Beacon Hill hammers out a billion-dollar budget deal. It was a big week of news, and joining us to help us sort through it for our week in review, Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. And as always, great to have you, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And by phone, Peter Gilzenis, columnist for the Boston Herald. Great to have you, Peter. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
So let's start, gentlemen, with a case of James Whitey Bulger, which is hard to avoid these days. The accused mobster was in court this week for various reasons, one of which was over his legal counsel. The prosecution argued he had the means to retain a private lawyer. His brother, Billy Bulger, could help him out, they said. But a judge ruled he was indigent and appointed a public defender. It's veteran defense attorney J.W. Carney who admits that he's got a big job ahead of him.
It's clear there will be tens of thousands of pieces of paper that we need to put eyeballs on, as well as thousands of exhibits. It's going to be a daunting task, but we're going to be up to it. We guarantee that.
So, Peter Gilzenis, let me start with you. A daunting task. How daunting?
extremely daunting. I said in a column I wrote today, it kind of reminded me of the lawyers who were asked to stand up and mount the defense at Nuremberg. I mean, there are high profile clients, and Jay Carney has certainly had more than his share, but I think this is on a completely different level in many respects, and partly because of all of the attendant hysteria and speculation and kind of media interest in this whole thing. It just ratchets it up.
Yeah, it's going to be huge. And let me say a word or two about J.W. Carney and ask you guys what you know about him. He's one of the state's best-known criminal lawyers. He's got a record of taking on difficult cases. He defended, among others, John Salvey, who shot up two clinics that provided abortion in the 1990s and killed two people. So Peter Canellos, he's no stranger to sort of high-profile, difficult and complicated cases, but this is probably the biggest.
Yes, and it's also worth noting that racketeering cases in general are very, very hard to prove and involve a lot of complicated connections. You know, the evidence will be of the nature of phone conversations between one person and another and former mobsters, you know, who've testified at various places. So it's going to be a big, complicated case. On top of all the things that Peter mentioned. So I wouldn't expect a quick and easy, in and out, put away Whitey decision on this.
Right. Now, Whitey Bulger's former attorney, his provisional attorney, Peter Krupp, said it's going to be very difficult to find a jury that hasn't been tainted in some way by the media coverage and the sort of spectacular publicity that this case has attracted. Do you think they're going to try to move this case out of Boston, for example, Peter Gilzenis?
We asked Jay that yesterday, and he said that would be something he wasn't prepared to really sort of comment on yesterday. But I got the sense just from the way he fielded some of the questions that he thinks it's possible. I mean, he is not sort of. I didn't get the impression yesterday anyway that this was something that's this was going to be his first line of defense, was to get out of town. I think, you know, he did say words to the effect that, look, you know, he and his associate, Janice Basil, have really made a career out of this over the last 30 years. And you know, he thinks it's possible to find a jury that would be fair. And I we'll just have to see. I don't know if I think at this point it's that's kind of a hard thing for a lot of the media that were down there yesterday and asking him these questions. I think it was impossible for them to kind of imagine that scenario. But again, this is going to play out over a very long period of time. And, you know, I think a lot of the kind of novelty of seeing him in the flesh in the courtroom in a prison jumpsuit and all of this other stuff that surrounded it, the motorcades, the helicopter, you know, I think as time goes forward, I don't think it's ever going to be old hat, but I don't think it's going to maintain this kind of level, because this is going to be a drawn out affair. And some of it is, you know, before they get, if they ever really get to the juice, there's going to be a lot of process stuff and stuff that is, you know, pretty arcane, I think, in some respects. You know?
And speaking of a drawn-out affair, we did a show with a couple of knowledgeable criminal defense lawyers in the studio, and, I mean, people were speculating maybe as long as a year. I mean, this could really take a long time, right, Peter?
And he's 81.
Yeah,
I mean, he's a very, very healthy-looking 81, I'll say that. But, you know, the other thing nobody got into with Jay yesterday is a question that still, you know, kind of is out there, is what will he do? I mean, you know, is it, will we go through the whole legal process, or will there be a point at which he decides to do something? I mean, that's still out there.
Sure.
You know, he could, for instance, you know, try to. There's some speculation. I've talked to people who said, look, you know, they could imagine a quote unquote deal where he asks for, you know, a kind of blanket immunity for his family, for Catherine Grieg's family, in exchange for, you know, X amount of things he could theoretically give up.
What do you think, Peter Kanellis? I want to get you back in this conversation. I got to say, it's confusing because I've got two Peters here. So, I better call
that.
You Mr. Kanellis and Mr. Gelsenis from going forward. But Peter C., I want to get you in. What do you think about Peter's suggestion about a deal? Possible? Likely?
Yeah, I think, well, it's very tough. There isn't too much that they can offer him. There's a lot that Whitey could offer to prosecutors. But I think that it, especially given the federal treatment.
I think we just lost Peter Kanellis in our connection to the Globe. Peter Gelsenis, you're still with us, I hope.
I'm right here.
Well,
right here.
We'll work on getting that connection to the Boston Globe back. Peter, I wanted to move on to a different but related subject. I just wanted to ask you, you're from South Boston. How is the community adapting to this story 1 week and 1 day after the capture? What's your impression as someone who lives there?
Well, I think, like everybody else, I think people were stunned that you know, I think they came to believe that it wouldn't happen, or it would happen in a different way. That perhaps when he got too ill to sustain himself out on the road, that some arrangements would be made and he'd come back. The other thing is, there's been a great deal of change in the town.
Yep.
So you still have a core group of people who will kind of wax somewhat nostalgic about, you know, an old code or, you know, sort of an older way of life that seemed to make sense, and he seemed to occupy a place in that.
Yep.
But they understand that all of the haunts that he once reigned over,
sure,
are gone. Many of them, they've changed. The real estate here has dramatically changed in the last 16 years. So in a way, it's almost kind of ancient history for certainly a lot of the influx of new people here.
Yeah, and yet, Peter Kanellis, and I think we have you back now. We lost your connection to the Globe briefly there. We were just talking about sort of how folks in South Boston are sort of adjusting, responding, adapting to this story. And I wanted to sort of, you know, I was struck by how raw these wounds still remain in South Boston. I mean, on our program, we've talked to a bunch of folks who have been affected by this story over the years in various ways. It's quite a trauma, and the wounds still are still very raw. And I just wanted to get your take on that. Peter Canellos.
Well, my take is that I think it's helping Boston get beyond a very bad period. And it wasn't just a bad period in terms of gang-related violence. It was also a bad period in terms of ethnic rivalries, in terms of viewing everything in terms of class and race and ethnicity and neighborhood and which, you know, people outside Boston, which town you came from. I think that we're putting to rest an entire era and becoming, in some ways, the 21st century city that we all want to have. And part of that is recognizing that Whitey Bulger's victims were the people of South Boston. This wasn't a case of, you know, one community that he was representing, you know, plaguing other people. This was him plaguing his own community. And I think it puts to rest some of those myths that Peter was talking about before, about loyalty and standing up for your own and all that kind of stuff.
I think that's a great point.
No, it's absolutely true. Mm. It's absolutely true. I mean, he preyed on people here primarily. And I think when the revelations came out about the FBI and the FBI's involvement in this and how, you know, they shielded him, it only made those wounds, that much more painful.
Well, let's move on, I'm afraid, to another sad story, the continuing story of violence in the streets of Boston. This week, a four-year-old boy shot in the back at a park in Dorchester, known by most locals as Franklin Field. Fortunately, we can report that the child is expected to survive. But for the family, for the residents of this part of the city, there's an understandable concern about how to keep kids safe this summer. Here's Lillian Bonilla, who lives a block from where the shooting occurred. She and her husband and three kids decided to return to the park this week after initially planning to stay away.
When stuff like this happens, you know, we hesitate to bring our kids out. But then we realized we need to show them that we're not scared, and we can't be scared. This is our neighborhood. This playground is where our kids come and play, our future. And if we're always, you know, closed up inside, then they win, and we cannot allow that.
Peter Canellos, Boston was once known as having this kind of problem under control, the Boston Miracle. What needs to happen? Can the city make these neighborhoods safer?
I have some confidence in the Boston police and their ability to do that. You know, obviously, whenever something like this happens, it does harken back to an era when there were large parts of the city that were truly unsafe, and there was real fear of a long, hot summer. And those fears are not absent today, but I do think that the Boston police are taking it seriously, and just the level of attention this one shooting has gotten and the different strategies that are being employed to try to keep Franklin Field safe, give me some confidence that the city and the police are on top of these things.
Mm. Peter Gelsenis, do you agree with, do you share that confidence?
No, I do. I think there, you know, the notion of the police establishing ties, building coalitions within the community, tapping into key people who are attuned to what's going on in the streets is a much better strategy and a much more I think efficient strategy overall. But I still think there's a variable here which is frightening in itself, and that is it can happen at any time. Mm. I mean this is a sad song. This is, you know, Trina Prasad a couple of years ago. I spoke to Tanya David a couple of nights ago. She is the mother of Kaylee Harriet. And you know, when the news broke over the television, you know, they just were catapulted back to a time when this little girl was you know, caught a stray bullet on a porch.
Yep.
That paralyzed her. And, you know, I spent some time this afternoon with the captain in Dorchester and a worker in the community, and they're dedicated to fighting for their neighborhoods. I mean, both the officer who went out, or the captain actually, who went out with a community service officer leafleting recently. This was after the second shooting on Olney Street. But it's just, you know, they know really who the players are, and the irony is it's a very small segment that are creating this kind of fear, and not even fear mostly, but panic, because you don't know, it can come out of nowhere, and for really no apparent reason. You know, the reasoning for these things is in many situations kind of non-existent. But it's very, very dangerous because you have, you know, guns in the hands of children themselves, essentially, and it's just the uncertainty. You know,
yeah.
It's not so much that, as Peter said, it's not so much that you have these places now that are. That are cloaked in fear. It's not that, and that park is certainly not in that situation. It's just that at any moment
it can happen.
Right.
And
know?
So who wants to? I mean, it's something that folks shouldn't have to be dealing with
right.
with their families.
Right.
And in fact, this wasn't the only shooting in Dorchester this week. Yesterday, a 38-year-old Nicholas Trotman was found dead with a gunshot wound in his head. So the problem goes on. Just this afternoon, the 10-Point Coalition, the Boston faith-based community group, announced the beginning of what it calls the annual season of peace, along with law enforcement. Here's Coalition Executive Director, the Reverend Jeffrey Brown.
Too many times and too many summers that we've had violence that has not only hit those who are gang members, but also folks who have absolutely nothing to do with the violence.
So, Peter Canellos, you know, over the years, Boston's faith-based community has cooperated, has had good relationships with Boston police. They've played an important role in reducing violence. As far as you can tell, are those relationships still intact in the city?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very much the same players that were around. And I might add, there are other ways in which I think the police are behaving in a competent manner. You know, when we talked to them after the shooting of the 4-year-old, you know, they were sort of saying that securing Franklin Field, you know, there are easy things you can do. You can cite people for anything that would be a violation to sort of keep stray kids off of the park to make sure it's safe for families. So I think it's a serious concern heading into the summer that this is going to be a summer of youth violence. But we should keep in mind that so far we've had relatively few murders this year, and I think the police are on top of things.
Well, it's a sad, sad story, and we have to turn to another one. This one that was supposed to be at a safe public pool. 36-year-old Marie Joseph drowned at a state-run swimming pool in Fall River. She apparently drowned on Sunday. Her body wasn't discovered until Tuesday night. Here's another bizarre detail in this awful story. State officials inspected the facility on Monday, which would mean they apparently didn't notice the body. Here's Fall River Mayor William Flanagan.
Health inspectors from the city visited the pool on Monday and on Tuesday. The only abnormal note in the report is that the water clarity was cloudy.
Cloudy water. Can that really have been all that kept this woman from going unnoticed for 2 days? Peter Gelzenis, does this make sense to you in any way, this story?
Not in any way.
Yeah.
I just find it, there were people talking. It was just, this was idle chatter yesterday. I wasn't talking about this story. It was actually down at the courthouse, but people were wondering whether there was something else afoot here that, you know, maybe this was a situation where, you know, a body was dumped or something like that, because they just...
I mean, that's what occurred to me. You have to believe that, because the idea that a body was floating in the bottom of the pool for 2 or 3 days...
And you've got inspectors. You've got inspectors theoretically looking at this.
Right.
And so it just kind of strained all credulity to think that, you know, that would happen like that. And then I'm a little troubled by the child, I guess, she was with, and why that wasn't reported earlier, why it took a couple of days for that story to come out, in terms of, you know, I guess, you know, I don't know who he went to, supposedly, when she went, I guess, down the slide and didn't come up, but... It's a baffling story. It's just, I think one of the accounts of the words in the paper today was grisly, in the sense of thinking that there were other children and stuff, playing in that pool for the past couple of days.
Well, Peter Canellos, 24 state pools were closed after Marie Joseph's body was discovered. Several were set to reopen today. I'm sure every parent wants to know, are these pools safe enough? What do you think?
Well, I would certainly recommend that parents keep a close eye on their kids there and not trust the lifeguard situation. And that's not to say that there aren't lots of competent lifeguards, but I don't think it's a good practice to just sort of, you know, let everything hang out there and expect that a lifeguard's going to rescue you if something goes wrong. It's such a bizarre story and such a complicated story. I share that view that, you know, there could be something that we don't know about this. You know, maybe the body was dumped in some way. But assuming that what everyone thinks is true, that the body was just there for 2 days hanging at the bottom of the pool while people were swimming in it and everything, it suggests some sort of a bizarre kind of a breakdown and, you know, all oversight at that pool. You know, the best thing to do is people should take all appropriate cautions while investigators do their best to unravel what happened.
And I guess, go ahead, Peter.
It's one thing. I living in South Boston, we did a lot more swimming in the Southie beaches years ago, and before they had the water treatment plants and stuff. So you would go down there some nights, and the water would be the color of Xyrex, you know. And people would, you know, because they were hot, and this was a long time ago, you know, they would jump in. I mean, but that was, you know, that was theoretically, beachfront. And I wonder what kind of trade-offs people made in terms of jumping into a pool where the water looked real funky. I don't. You're right. I mean, Peter's right in the sense that I don't know how many parents, you know, were there and wondered about it and said, "Look, you know, you're not going in there." It's just a very, very strange.
Yeah, I have a feeling there's still a lot we don't know about this story, and they're going to be a surprise or two still to be revealed, but we'll stay tuned for that. Finally, let's move on to a little bit of a state budget. Both the House and the Senate today approved a $30.6 billion budget. It's on its way to the governor's desk. I guess what's drawn the most attention has been a measure to limit municipal union rights in negotiating certain health care benefits. The deal is expected to save cities and towns as much as $100 million. Here's Jeff Beckwith of the Mass Municipal Association reacting to the news today. This was after the House passed it.
There are many communities that are counting on this reform in order to make sure that their budget is balanced without further layoffs beyond what they've already adopted.
Gentlemen, let me ask, the unions oppose this in a big way, at least at the beginning. Is it a big blow to them in the end, Peter Canellos?
No, I don't think it's a big blow to the unions. And I have my own skepticism about this. The way it works is if the unions and the town managers can't come to an agreement, the case will go to a three-person panel, one person appointed by the unions, one person appointed by management, one person appointed by the governor. The situation there is that behind the scenes, labor will work on the governor, if it's a pro-labor governor, to put somebody on that panel who's going to be a second pro-labor vote. So if everybody in the process knows that there's a 2-to-1 majority pro-labor on that panel, it's going to limit what cities and towns can do greatly to make these changes. So I, for one, am not, you know, extremely excited over this deal. I don't think it's going to deliver the kind of savings that the Municipal Association is hopeful for. And I do think that getting that savings is very, very important. So, this was not the worst bill in the world, but I don't think it's any panacea.
Mm. And can we assume that Governor Patrick, he's going to sign this, right? He's been a little sort of, he hasn't been completely out in the open about how he feels about this issue, what he's going to do, but we can assume that he's going to sign this, right?
Yes.
At this point. Peter Galzanis, what's your take on this budget discussion?
Well, I think, you know, if it doesn't sort of happen, you know, this is going to be a process where I think the unions are really going to have to, at some point, you know, face reality here because, you know, they're at cross purposes with their, you know, their own neighbors, their own communities in terms of the services that need to be delivered. So, it's sort of like moving a boulder uphill, I guess. But I think, you know, there's been discussions. There's it is out there now, and I think Peter's right. I mean, it may not be what everybody hopes for this time around. But I don't think I don't think we're going to go back to a situation where, you know, you can pay, you know, people don't understand the amount of money that is going to fund these kinds of healthcare costs.
Peter Canellis, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say I wish I could be that optimistic. I mean, I'm fearful that when all the negotiating gets done, the union, not much will change, and the unions will maintain their positions there. And what people should understand is all of us in the private sector are accustomed to these changes in health plans and even kind of welcome some of them because you know that it saves your employer a lot of money and can prevent layoffs. These minor changes in plans that the unions are going crazy over, and it's just not appropriate.
Well, I guess it's this slippery slope argument. They're minor changes, but is it opening the doorway to big, big changes down the road? I think that's the concern, right?
Well, certainly the concern, but it's something that everybody has gotten used to in the private sector,
sure.
And the public
right.
sector should follow suit on.
All right. Well, let's turn now to our weekly hubbub, that story that didn't really land above the fold, but that struck you nonetheless. And Meghna, let me get you back into this conversation. Let's start with you, your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub actually has to do with water. And Peter Gelsenis, I heard you mention that even back in the day, you used to swim on the South Boston beaches regardless of what color the water was.
Right. That's correct.
So mine has to do with a different body of water in the greater Boston area, and that's the Charles River. My family and I, every 4th of July, we rent a canoe and sort of head down the river to watch the fireworks. And the greatest thing is, on the way back at night, the river is littered with the plastic shells from the fireworks. They're like these big frisbee-sized plastic things.
Oh.
But and so they're like great little souvenirs of the 4th of July. But the actual hubbub that I have has to do with the fact that the Charles River has been named one of three finalists in the International Rivers Foundation Award for best river cleanup. And previous winners include the Thames, the Danube, and the Mekong. So,
wow, we're in good company.
Yeah, the Charles being recognized for going on 40 years now of restoration work. So hopefully they'll win later this year.
Great. Peter Canellis, what have you got?
I've also got a 4th of July one, and that is while the Boston Pops concert is going to get ready and go this weekend, at the same time, out at Tanglewood in Western Massachusetts, James Taylor is giving four concerts to benefit the BSO. This is going to raise millions of dollars for the Boston Symphony. As we all know, it costs a ton to put on a symphony orchestra. It's a great jewel for Boston. James Taylor, it's not his kind of music, but he's really taken it on and become kind of the patron saint of the BSO. And so it's a great way to give back to your community, and he is.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Peter Gelsenis, let's get your hubbub.
It's essentially something I kind of gave you a preview of a few minutes ago. I spent some time this morning with actually the cousin of Nicholas Trotman, who was killed a couple of days ago. And the captain of Area C-11, Dick Sexton, and the woman's name, the cousin is a woman by the name of Philomene Leptiste. She's a 34-year-old woman who occupies a pivotal position at the Bowdoin Street Health Center. And the work of her life is to basically work with people to improve their lives in a variety of ways, including violence prevention. And yet, she found out this week that her cousin was killed. And the thing that was touching was that I guess in the moments after or shortly after he was killed, she learned that Sexton had gone out and was leafleting the area. They have a very close working relationship. She is one of the go-to people for him in terms of all kinds of things. And these are not issues. These are issues just of ongoing interest to the police as they keep an ear tuned to the streets. And so. You know, there was something very touching about the fact that she finds herself now ensnared in this, and
sure.
She actually lives next door to the family of Nicholas Farmby Davis, a 14-year-old who was killed last summer. So she was touched by this then, but she's in a much different, a much more visceral place now. And yet, it's just kind of
yeah.
reinvigorated her purpose to do what she does. So I was
Peter, let me jump in there because I want to try to make room for my hubbub, which is a little bit of a mood changer, a little bit of a preview for next week. Earlier today, I spoke with comedian Paula Poundstone, who, as people know, is a part of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on a regular basis. She's actually from Sudbury, Mass. She'll be performing in Massachusetts next week. Anyway, fun part of the conversation is what she had to say about her adopted state of California. So let's listen to that.
I live here, and as we have shown more than once, we are the stupidest state in the land. The only thing that California really has done in recent years that's worth mentioning or celebrating is that because we had Schwarzenegger for governor for so long, he was unable to make any of those movies.
So thank you, California, for protecting all of us from years of the Terminator. And thank you to our guests, Peter Kanellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, Peter Gilzanis, columnist for the Boston Herald. Thanks so much. Stay with us. Still ahead, we've got plenty more to come. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.